Castle Rock Radio, the future of radio.
Welcome to Food Integrity Now. I'm one of your hosts, Carol Gravet. I'm here with Susan Wright. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you.
Matt is not with us today, but we have a very exciting show planned. We have as our guest Larry Jacobs. Larry is an organic farmer, and his farm is Jacobs Farm in California. And we're excited to have him on the show. I'm going to let Larry discuss the court case that he recently won regarding cross-contamination. And this is a really hot topic right now with USDA approving alfalfa, organic alfalfa, and we wanted to discuss that with him. So welcome, Larry.
Hi there.
Good to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're excited to have you. So for our listeners, why don't you explain what happened 4 years ago and how you ended up in an appeals court?
We farm fresh culinary herbs on the California, on the coast, in the middle of a state park that's bordered by the Pacific Ocean, the Santa Cruz Mountains, and in wetlands areas to our east and west, and beyond that, commercial Brussels sprout fields. In 2006, we got a call from a customer, Whole Foods Market, and letting us know that they had found residues on dill that we had shipped to their Chicago distribution center. We were surprised to hear that there was any pesticide residues that we had never used any chemicals since we began farming in California, which is 1980. And then when we traced back the product from that they were reporting the residues on, it was from this farm in the middle of a state park, in a very pristine environment that we had been farming organically for 10 years. So that was a double whammy. How could this be possible? And what we learned when we began pulling samples from the rest of the farm and testing the product from the block from where their sample has come from was that indeed there was widespread contamination of the crops that we were growing, albeit at low levels, but detectable levels.
Wow. And maybe some of our listeners may not understand how cross-contamination works. How exactly does that happen?
So we've got pretty good laws in the state of California that and good regulations for those people using chemical pesticides. And those laws were designed to protect the public and protect non-target crops. But there's no, at the end of the day, people are still using materials that are toxic and poisonous, and designed to, they're designed to kill insects. Mm-hmm. And the way these things move is, they move when they're being at the time of application. They can move if they're applied during windy conditions. By and large, the body of regulation addresses that point of contamination. The risk of materials moving while they're being sprayed or at the time of application. So there's regulations as to how much wind there can be and under what kinds of conditions these things can be applied, and droplet size as to the equipment that's being used, how the distance from the spray boom to the plant. There's just a long list of requirements and regulations and how these materials are supposed to be used, correctly used.
And how are these regulated?
And they're regulated by, in the state of California, they're regulated by the Department of Pesticide Regulation. And that's, the on-the-ground regulation is done by county agricultural commissioners and through the county ag commissioner's office. In our particular case, we were having contamination not caused by the movement of materials at the time of application. And it's one of the things that made this case unique. The chemicals that were being used in the neighboring area evaporate after being sprayed. And just in the word that's used in the regulation is they volatilize. But this is really the same thing as evaporation. And you can think of this as, you know, some materials are like salt. If you put some salt on a table, it will sit there forever unless it gets wet, but it doesn't evaporate. The molecules of the salt crystals don't turn to a gas and leave the table. But if you spill some water on a table and you wait long enough, the water will all disappear, will all evaporate, the table will dry off. When a material goes from being a liquid or a solid to a gas, those molecules change form. They go up into the atmosphere and they can drift. They can move around. So what was happening with the organophosphates were being used in the surrounding farms was after they were being sprayed, after they were applied, they would begin to evaporate off the surface of the plants that they were applied to. And they would go into the air as a gas. And because we're in an area where there was fog, the fog would move in over these fields and pick up pick up molecules of the pesticide and concentrate it on the small molecules of water in the fog, and then move around. The fog can move back out to sea and then come back out over our crops and redeposit as dew on the crops. And another mechanism was just the stuff was evaporating as a gas coming off the field. And if you think of a sort of smoldering field of fire, and you can see the smoke coming off a field, and then the smoke just will then move with the wind in different directions. Mm-hmm. And those were the two things that were happening. And unfortunately, we were in a place where where the fog and the wind was moving these molecules back over our crop, and the conditions were right so that they would recondense on the crops that we were growing at detectable levels.
Mm.
So the several things that lined up. One was there was a clear indication of contamination from crops being sprayed someplace else. It was very repeatable. It happened every time we'd go out and take a sample. We would find stuff. It would happen month after month. And as soon as we became aware of the problem, we alerted the county ag commissioner, who reported the problem, and we stopped all harvest at the farm and reported a crop loss. And we began investigating what was going on. Where were these materials coming from? One good thing in the state of California is the requirement that all applications be reported to the county ag commissioner. So there is a good database in every county in the state of California as to what's being applied and where. And that's the requirement. That's required by law.
Is that just California, or do other states have that?
California is one of the few states that requires that. It may be the only. It's the only one that I'm aware of.
Oh, that's a shame, isn't it?
And it is a problem in other areas of the country because we don't really know. There is no public record of what's being applied.
Mm.
And you're absolutely right. It is a shame. But at least in this state, we're able to go to the record and look who's applying what and where. So we were able to see that we were able to determine what was being applied around us and who was doing the application. And with that information, we were able to contact them and say, we've got a problem. We need you to fix it because we're not using these materials. You guys are.
Mm-hmm. What was the response to that?
Their response was that was both professional and responsible. They said that they would do their best to correct the problem. What was unfortunate was they didn't address what was the mechanism for which these materials were moving, which was the evaporation. They dealt with the issue of drift as it happens at time of application. And here's where the law was a bit was confusing. When you go in and you look, read our existing pesticide law, it clearly says that the applicator is responsible to prevent the movement of these chemicals by drift, and that you've got to comply with all these different regulations to prevent drift as defined by law. And the catch is, drift is defined by law as being the movement of chemicals at the time of application, not after they're applied. Mm-hmm. After they're applied, the same body of law exempts the movement of these materials by means of volatilization or by means of attachment to dust or other particles blowing in the wind. And that created a problem for us because it indicated, well, legally, the movement of these things wasn't drift, but they were certainly moving. So what do you call them? And in our particular instance, what happened was when the county ag commissioner, who was charged to regulate at the local level what's going on, came to investigate our crop loss and to look to see if there was a violation of the pesticide regulations, found no violation of pesticide regulations.
Mm-hmm. So,
at the same time, issued us a stop harvest order because the crops we were growing are not allowed to have any residues on them. That was a little ridiculous because we had stopped harvesting long before, as soon as we had heard, we had stopped.
Right.
But it was counterintuitive that they found nobody responsible or nobody at fault for breaking any regulation.
Right. Larry, we're going to.
Causing repeated pesticide.
We want to hear more about how this all ended up in the appeals court. But we need to take a break right now to listen to our sponsors. You are listening to Food Integrity Now with our guest, organic farmer Larry Jacobs, and we will be right back. I'm Carol Gervais, and I'm a certified life coach and one of the hosts of the Food Integrity Now show right here on Castle Rock Radio. Have you ever dreamed of swimming with the wild and free dolphins? I'm not talking about the ones in captivity like the ones at Dolphin Quest. I'm talking about swimming with them in the wild. If this is something you've only dreamt about doing, I invite you to mark this off your bucket list now and join me for an all-inclusive trip to swim with the wild dolphins. Your trip to paradise will include organic gourmet meals, ocean waterfront accommodations, Lomi Lomi massage, and much more. What are you waiting for? Now is the time to make your dream a reality. For more information, go to wilddolphinswimadventures.com or contact me at carol@coachwithcarol.com or 719-687-7447. Once again, that's 719-687-7447. Mahalo.
Are you experiencing anxiety, anger, depression, or low self-esteem? Do you beat yourself up or sabotage what you truly want to achieve? Hi, this is Jeannie Smith, and at Open Heart Healing, I combine counseling, gestalt therapy, and Tai Chi energy work to assist those who truly desire to bring quality and joy back into their lives. My office is located on South Perry Street here in Castle Rock. Call me for a free consultation at 303-660-6373. Again, that's 303-660-6373, or visit me at openhearthealing.com.
Welcome back to Food Integrity Now. We have as our guest today Larry Jacobs, and Larry is an organic farmer. Larry, what are the names of your farms so people can know and check you out online?
We grow fresh culinary herbs in two counties, in San Mateo and Santa Cruz County.
Okay.
And the herbs are labeled Jacobs Farm.
Okay.
That's what we do in California. My wife and I also started 1985. We began organizing, teaching organic farming practices to the small-scale growers at the tip of the Baja California Peninsula, and that's become known as Del Cabo. You know, that's primarily little tiny cherry tomatoes.
Yeah, I'm familiar with those. They're yummy. That's exciting.
And they're all over the place today, although we had a bit of a freeze weekend before last that curtailed the production a little bit.
Yeah, we had that same freeze here. But Larry has been talking about a court case that he was involved with for cross-contamination and just been filling us in on how it all transpired. So you left off with, they informed you that you had to stop harvest, which you had already done. And then what happened after that?
Following the County Ag Commissioner's report, we continued discussing and talking with our neighbors and with the company that was doing the application, explaining that we were still picking up residues. And this went on for several months into the next year. And with the next year, following year came, and we still were having residue contamination problems after they would do an application. And we'd asked them to curtail their applications of those materials, to use other materials. We faced a difficult decision. We were either going to have to stop farming in that location because we weren't going to be able to grow a crop there that would meet the National Organic Food Act requirement, or we were going to have to move, or we would have to require them to stop using those materials. And the only way we looked like we were going to get them to do that was to go to court, and that's what happened. Began a long drawn out court battle that ultimately we prevailed. The case was about the contamination of non-target crops and the movement of pesticides after they were sprayed, mm-hmm. and whether an applicator had responsibility for preventing that from happening. And the case boiled down to a fairly simple case about trespass, nuisance, negligence, mm-hmm. and whether the applicator was responsible for causing trespass, creating a nuisance, and being negligent in terms of responding to a problem.
So the court ruled in your favor, correct?
And we had a jury trial in October of 2008, and the jury ruled in our favor, found that the applicator was responsible, and we were awarded damages for the loss of the crop for 2007, not for 2006, but for one of the 2 years. And the logic, our understanding was the logic of the jury was that in the prior year when the incidents first happened, that the applicator wasn't aware of the problem, but in the following year, they clearly were aware of the problem, but with repeated communications and a letter from our attorney,
mm-hmm.
and that so they held them responsible for the following year's crop losses. That case, that decision was appealed by the chemical company, the company that was doing the application.
Mm-hmm.
They appealed to the appellate court And that's, and they raise some interesting legal questions. They primarily raise the question of whether a judge and jury had the right to review and listen to a case that was involving the use of pesticides. They argue that the state of California maintains all jurisdiction over the regulation and the use of pesticides in the state, and that lower bodies, lower government bodies, including the judicial system, do not have the right to hear the case.
Oh, that's interesting. Hmm. So what happened with that then? How did that get overturned?
The appellate court, the three judges in the appellate court ruled in our favor. They upheld the lower court's decision of vindicating our position on the case.
Mm-hmm.
They argue that the pesticide regulation laws clearly define that the state does govern and has to say over all the use and transportation and application of pesticides, and that there is preemption language in the law, and that's true. And that came out of a Mendocino, something that happened in Mendocino, where there were some school children injured in a school bus that was caused by an aerial overspray of an herbicide in a timber area. And as a result of that, the county of Mendocino passed a ordinance that regulated the application of that herbicide. The applicator at the time, or I'm not sure if it was the applicator or the lumber company, challenged that ordinance, and that challenge went to the state Supreme Court, where they lost. And mm-hmm. the state Supreme Court upheld the Mendocino County's regulation and right to create that law. Subsequently, the a new law was passed in the legislature that made it illegal for counties to regulate the use of pesticides. And it was that law that was brought into question in this case. And our attorney argued that if the legislation had intended for the judicial system to not hear damage cases, they would have said so specifically in the law, and that we argued that the law was written to preempt counties, cities, and towns, lower government agencies, from creating new laws, not from aggrieved party or damaged parties from bringing a tort case to the judicial system. And in fact, the same bodies of laws has many examples of affirming the right of individuals to bring claims. And it's in my opinion, their case was weak. There was quite a bit of historical information in the record that upheld our position that the judicial branch was not being preempted by this regulation. So that was part of the appeal. The other part of the appeal was they argued that the case had been heard by the county ag commissioner, and that the county ag commissioner had found that there was nobody at fault, and so hence that they were being tried or judged again when it was taken to a jury trial, and that even if we didn't like the decision that the county ag commissioner made, that we had an appeal process that was in place, that we could have gone back and appealed that decision that the county ag commissioner made. And we didn't see it that way. From our perspective, the county ag commissioner's decision was not a decision that affected us, they had not said that we had done anything wrong, but there was nothing for us to appeal. Because the way that's set up is a county ed commissioner may find that an applicator has done something, has applied a pesticide incorrectly, and that then the applicator may be fined and, you know, may have their license taken away if it's a real severe breaking, egregious act.
Mm-hmm.
So there was nobody, you know, we weren't fined, and we weren't reprimanded by the county ag commissioner. We didn't have anything to appeal. So there wasn't, the system wasn't really set up to address this kind of a situation. And it wasn't what it was meant for. So in all counts, the appeal court vindicated our position and felt like we had a strong argument for upholding the lower court's decision.
Well, it sounds like there's a lot of opportunity, and I think probably we've seen that in the news where the court system's law does not work, and this time it did, and that...
It's encouraging.
It's very encouraging, and we're going to take a break right now, but we'd like to talk about GMO alfalfa and what your take is on how that was just kind of passed through just recently. And we'll be right back with Larry Jacobs, organic farmer, on Food Integrity Now.
Breathe, dear.
If you are looking for some flavorful, healthy, fresh food, come out to Maximilian's Cafe in Woodland Park, Colorado, focusing on local, fresh ingredients with a changing seasonal menu. Located at 209 East Midland Avenue, Woodland Park, Colorado, right off Highway 24 in downtown. Our walls are full of local artist artwork, and on Friday and Saturday nights, we feature local singers, songwriters, and performers to entertain you while you relax and enjoy a fun environment, a glass of wine, and fantastic food. Open 7 days a week from 11 to 9 p.m., 11 to 8 p.m. on Sunday and Monday.
Are you seeking understanding and assistance in healing your depression and anger or lack of passion? Hi, my name is Tammy Urbanik at Empowerment Through Healing. I'm a medium clairvoyant who can work with your spirit guides to assist you. Your spirit guides can offer solutions and understanding at current life issues that you're facing. Visit www.empowermentthroughhealing.com for more information, and you can call me at 719-641-2017.
Holistic Pathways is your local herbal medicine clinic. You can find them online at holisticpathways.com. Holistic Pathways supplies certified organic and ethically wildcrafted bulk medicinal herbs, herbal extracts, and essential oils. Holistic Pathways offers Mayan abdominal massage and specializes in women's health and fertility. Call 720-570-2454 to speak to a certified clinical herbalist today. That's Holistic Pathways at 720-570-2454.
Welcome back to Food Integrity Now. We've been talking with Larry Jacobs, organic farmer. He won a court case, very encouragingly, concerning contamination of his fields with a pesticide. And we wanted to, you know, I think as you were talking, it became apparent to me why it's so overwhelming, I think, for farmers to want to even take on these types of battles, because the law is so complicated and there are so many ways for it to be interpreted that, you know, it might end up failing, or I'm sure that you are familiar with that feeling. But I wanted to ask what your take is on what happened with GMO alfalfa, which has been a big battle, I think, being passed regardless of all of those that were opposed.
Right. So it was disheartening to hear the recent announcement from USDA that GMO alfalfa has been deregulated. I'm not sure if that's the right term.
I think it is.
That
sounds right to me.
What's disconcerting about the deregulation of GMO alfalfa is that the pollen from alfalfa is insect carried. Hence the likelihood of contamination, of pollinization of alfalfa plants that are not GMO alfalfa. Hence the integrity of future alfalfa seed to be GMO-free is highly at risk.
Which also, you know, is going to affect our dairy and our meat, and it really is disheartening.
Right. So that's where this goes, is that the dairy industry and the meat industry, the organic dairy industry,
right,
and the organic meat industry depend on alfalfa as a feed source, especially during the winter. And if they can't find a source of organic alfalfa, they won't be in compliance with the National Organic Food Act.
Mm-hmm.
And that presents a conundrum. Setting aside the concerns and that people have regarding the potential negative impacts of consuming products that are genetically modified, sometimes that not being a well-understood area or not well-researched area, that just looking at today's regulation, organic dairy producers and organic meat producers are going to have one heck of a time finding a source of alfalfa at some point in the future that does not have some genetic markers in it.
Mm-hmm.
Of GMO, genetically modified crops.
How do you
and
think
that is? That's really difficult.
Mm-hmm.
The ability to prevent the contamination of non-GMO crops with pollen from GMO crops is what creates the problem.
And how do you think this happened with the USDA? What's your take? I mean, I obviously have a take on it, and we've talked about this quite a bit on our show, but from the perspective of being an organic farmer, how do you think this happened?
Well, you're really putting me on the spot here, huh?
Well, that's what we do on this show. We talk about the real deal, and, you know, this is just your opinion.
Right. Well, so how the decisions are made,
mm-hmm,
that regulate the use of pesticides, or I guess we could talk about any industry, but the people that are manufacturing this stuff and the people that are making a living doing it are arguing their case, and clearly they're doing a better job than we are at arguing that these things are safe and need to be introduced. How deep is your pocket?
Right.
And how much money can you invest in the lobbying effort,
mm-hmm,
and the influence peddling to get your point across?
Yeah. Well, education is key, and that's one of the things that, you know, that's why we do this show. We've had Jeffrey Smith on here, who's probably one of the most knowledgeable people in the world on genetically modified food and others. And, you know, it really is about education, Larry, because some people just don't know or don't want to know, you know, what's in their food. And again, as Jeffrey said, we can't fight, you know, the Monsantos and the Cargills, because they have so much money. The way that we can create a tipping point is by education and just not buying their products.
Certainly, that's a beginning step for making a strong political statement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm an optimist, and I believe in people. And deep down, I've got to believe that the individuals working in the different companies that are manufacturing these products believe they're doing the right thing. And I think you're absolutely right that education and better understanding is the key to moving the planet to a safer, better place for all of us. And that includes all those the scientists, the policymakers, and the administrators in these big companies. Because as they have the potential for doing great harm, and I wish to believe that they're not doing it. It's not something that they believe they're doing intentionally. That they're doing something. I can't believe that they think they're knowingly doing something that's causing harm. I got to believe that they think they're not. But that education, understanding, and of what we're doing and the long-term ramifications and the externality cost becomes better understood by everybody. And so that those individuals making the management decisions in these companies begin to make better decisions so they're better for all of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really interesting what you're saying, that they don't mean to be doing harm. And I think that's probably true. I watched a really interesting documentary called The Corporation, and it brought out that point that corporations are made up of people that are very usually very kind and very very responsible in their personal lives, but that corporations are generally they are required by law to place their profits above anything else. And
right, that problem of being human economicists instead of human beings who have endowed with compassion and understanding and generosity.
Mm-hmm.
It's not part of the makeup of a corporation.
Right. And
corporations, for the most part, don't have hearts. And
right.
I think that the individuals in corporations, can have a heart, but there is a bottom line. And there is, I think there's an agenda at a very top level. There are people that are working for corporations that may not consciously know that their products are harmful, but I think ultimately the guys at the top do.
I don't have any way of knowing that one way or another, but I would certainly argue that profit motive, the drive to be more profitable, skews judgment and creates problems.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that happens regardless of how big or small the company is.
Mm-hmm.
It happens for individuals. The case in point, somebody who robs a bank.
Yeah.
So.
But again, I don't think it does us any good to be pointing our fingers and going, they're the bad guys, they're the bad guys, they're the bad guys. So what? All we can do is take steps to either say, no, we're not going to buy this, or no, we're not going to accept this. And because the pointing the fingers and the judgment, that doesn't do a thing. It doesn't change anything. Again,
and certainly work to gaining better understandings of the issues, becoming better educated,
and
working to have more and more people understand have an in-depth understanding of the problems, the issues, and the science of these things that we're talking about.
Right,
that's got to be the way to get there.
Right, and educating our children too in that regard. We've had people on the show before that have talked about, getting your kids involved with where does your food come from, how is it grown, and having them be involved in that whole process rather than thinking that food just comes out of a can or a box, to really educate educate our children. I think that's absolutely, very important.
Absolutely.
And
so one thing, Sandra and I, my wife and I are both very enheartened by, is to see this new crop of young people coming into the workplace who are enthusiastic about food, care about where their food comes from, and getting involved in the growing of food for people to eat. And we're seeing, we've just hired a couple of new young people and had a whole slate of people apply for the job, all very enthusiastic, bright, energetic, young individuals who have a level of awareness that seemed was remarkable, mm-hmm. about our food system, about how food's grown, about the importance of soil, about the importance of creating an environment where life flourishes instead of a place, farms where that's built on the paradigm of killing pests, the paradigm of creating good habitats for insects. And it's just, 20, 30 years ago, you just didn't have that.
Yeah.
So there's certainly some good things happening at the same time that we're facing lots
of new problems. Yeah, and I think it's important to talk about that, and we are going to take a break. And in this final segment, let's talk about what people can do, how they can get involved, how they can educate their children, what the small farmer can do, and really end this show on a positive note of how we can make a difference. You are listening to Food Integrity Now with Larry Jacobs, Organic Farmer, and we will be right back. I'm Carol Gervais, and I'm a certified life coach and one of the hosts of the Food Integrity Now show right here on Castle Rock Radio. Have you ever dreamed of swimming with the wild and free dolphins? I'm not talking about the ones in captivity like the ones at Dolphin Quest. I'm talking about swimming with them in the wild. If this is something you've only dreamt about doing, I invite you to mark this off your bucket list now and join me for an all-inclusive trip to swim with the wild dolphins. Your trip to paradise will include organic gourmet meals, ocean waterfront accommodations, Lomi Lomi massage, and much more. What are you waiting for? Now is the time to make your dream a reality. For more information, go to wilddolphinswimadventures.com or contact me at carol@coachwithcarol.com or 719-687-7447. Once again, that's 719-687-7447. Mahalo.
Are you experiencing anxiety, anger, depression, or low self-esteem? Do you beat yourself up or sabotage what you truly want to achieve? Hi, this is Jeannie Smith, and at Open Heart Healing, I combine counseling, gestalt therapy, and Tai Chi energy work to assist those who truly desire to bring quality and joy back into their lives. My office is located on South Perry Street here in Castle Rock. Call me for a free consultation at 303-660-6373. Again, that's 303-660-6373, or visit me at openhearthealing.com.
Welcome back to Food Integrity Now. We've been talking with Larry Jacobs. Larry's an organic farmer that won an appellate court case regarding cross-contamination. And Larry, during this last segment, I would like to talk about, let's end this on a positive note of what your take is. First of all, for small farmers, do you have any advice or anything you want to say to somebody that has a small organic farm about what they can do regarding cross-contamination or just any other type local advice?
If you have a problem with contamination on your farm in the state of California, call your county ag commissioner and report it. And that is that's the place to begin. And if it's something that appears to be it's going to be a repeated problem, contact if you can identify where it's coming from. I think the first step is to try to have a dialogue with the people who are doing the application and see if you can't nip it in the bud right there and prevent it from continuing. I think most people nobody wants to damage somebody else's crop. And in most instances, I think you'll find neighbors trying to be neighborly. But as a last resort, the courts will uphold damages for contamination losses. Although I caution individuals that taking something like this through the court system is expensive and not the most enjoyable experience in the world. I would categorize it as the route of last recourse when you've exhausted all other possibilities.
I think actually there are organizations out there that are created to support local and organic farmers in these processes. Have you heard of those?
I know that you can probably get help from CAF in the state of California. Mm-hmm. And Pesticide Action Network has done a lot of work in understanding causes of pesticide contamination and drift issues, and they've got technical staff that can help dissect a problem and figure out what's going on. And I know there's organizations across the country that are concerned with the misuse of pesticides and the movement of pesticides to where they're not meant to be. But specifically for a small grower, I'm only familiar with what's going on in California, but I know in the state of California, it's the county ag commissioners that are charged with regulating the use of those chemicals, and that's where you have to start. Mm-hmm. If you have a pesticide contamination issue, if you don't register the problem properly, you're not. And if you do find that you end up in court, then you won't have the proper documentation to back up the problem to begin with.
Right. So do you have any advice or information as far as how people can get their children involved in what they eat? And do you have any suggestions for people out there?
There are some really great programs all across the country, education involving young people in farms, visiting farms, having meals on farms, planting gardens, both urban landscapes and urban gardens and in the school systems. The Life Labs program is one that I'm aware of in California. But I know that and I've read about it, and we've been involved in a couple of them here on the West Coast, that work with young people. There's another group that works with high school kids, high school young adults, and many of them have had great success involving young people with the process of seed to fork as a medium for teaching leadership, self-esteem, and learning skills. not just about, you know, going beyond the plant and the food, but using those as tools for teaching young people skills for life as they grow, as they go forward in their years.
Yeah, that sounds like a great idea. You know, getting teenagers involved in it, and you know, I just think that on a family level, we need to educate our children too, and but that involves, you know,
taking
a look at, you know, what you eat every day, you know, opening up your cupboards and reading labels and making better choices health wise for your entire family, and talking to your kids about, you know, why you don't want to eat this processed food. And you know, and again, that's not always an easy thing to do because they're bombarded on television with, you know, all the ads for the non-nutrient dense foods out there, and it's just education, and I think it begins at home too.
Can't say that too many times. I was recalling as a two things that are easy to grow and that are really fun, and satisfying are radishes. They come up really fast, mm-hmm. and they're red. And in 3 weeks, you have something you can eat. And the other one is a corn plant. The big seed planted in a milk carton. Plant comes up. The wonder, we forget what it's like to be a child, is the wonder of watching a seed go from seed to a plant, and that moment of germination, that moment of this tender young plant, this little baby plant growing, developing, is a really great way for young people to develop that connection between the soil, the earth, and food and what we eat.
What a great idea, and anybody can do that in any setting, correct?
In any setting, you can do that in an apartment, or in a planter box, or in your backyard. You can grow corn in a little, like I said, in a milk carton. It comes mm-hmm. up, mm-hmm. and you can grow radishes. You don't need very much space to grow a few radishes. So those are two really inexpensive, easy to grow crops that it's hard to fail with, and that kids can. You can begin that journey of awe mm-hmm. that many of us have that begins when we're children.
Yeah, well, it's simple. I mean, it really doesn't take a whole lot to begin, you know, and I think that's why a lot of people don't take on, you know, like, well, I don't have the acreage to grow, or I, you know, I live in an apartment, but There are things you can do, and how do you feel about what's the hydroponics? Is that the thing that you grow inside in?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I have a friend who is growing tomatoes that way in his basement.
Yeah, but that could be something that, you know, kids could do, and you know, it would be like a interesting learning experience at home, kind of like doing your own little science experiment. That could be exciting. And so there are many ways to get your children involved, and talk to your teachers. Go to your school, see what your kids are eating. Talk to the administration about, you know, what kind of foods they're feeding your children. You know, it just, again, it takes us getting involved and not being passive, because if we don't do it, who will?
Right. And in that, you know, there are schools that are actually having organic gardens right on site and having that program for the kids. And
yeah,
that would be a very good thing to start maybe organizing in your own school and see what that takes to get that going. I think the kids really learn a lot, and they love that experience.
Yeah. So, well, Larry, thank you so much for being on our show today. You've been a wonderful guest, and actually you have made me feel a little bit more hopeful about our organic foods. You know, the fact that you won this case is definitely some good news, and we need good news these days when it comes to our food supplies. So good luck. Keep doing what you love doing and educating and growing wonderful food. So thanks again.
Thank you very much for having me. And keep on talking about food integrity.
We will. We will.
Yeah, we will.
Thank you so much. And in that regard, we are going to continue this conversation next week, and we're going to have an expert on. His name is Rick Thomas, and we're going to be talking more about the genetically modified alfalfa that has just been deregulated and how that is going to affect our entire food supply and kind of the domino effect of how that could affect our food supply and perhaps what we can do even on, on an individual level to say no to this. So you are listening to Food Integrity Now. Thank you, Susan. And
thank you,
we
Carol.
Will be back next week. And have a great week. Thanks.